Accession number 30505.
Mog Real 6. Can you take me through the battle at Langeres, which appears, I believe, in the 9th Battalion honours, does it not?
Yes, it is, and it is. It was a great experience, I can tell you. As I said before, on the last reel, we had time just to do a quick patrol that night, and that patrol ran into trouble, so we knew that the opposition in front of us was stiffening, and that there was a hard core of German, particularly 21 Panzer Division and the Panzer Lehr Division, we knew was somewhere in that area. And in front of us, the orchard where the battalion headquarters was a long expanse of a field of corn, then a long line. I wish I could describe it to you on the ground, but it's much easier then. But there were a long line of woods, which we thought the front line of those woods was held by the Germans. And Humphrey Woods came back at about 7 o'clock in the morning from brigade headquarters saying, we are going to attack Langeres, and we crossed the start line at 10:15 in the morning. And the start line was a little track running across, which ran parallel with the forward edge of these woods. he didn't say so, ever, but he was killed later, but he never said so. But I heard afterwards that when he had the orders, he said to the Brigadier, you know that if we do this, we shall have a tremendous number of casualties. We ought to do this attack at night, and we ought to have much more time for reconnaissance. And the Brigadier said, I know that, but I have been told this is a desperately important battle. We've got to get this village. We've got to go on so that the breakout can continue from the beachhead. And if we don't do it now, we may well find that the opposition is stiffening up all the time, so we've got to do it.
Was Langeres in some position which was of value?
You could just see the church from the orchard where we were, where we had our orders, and you could just see this wood. And in fact, Langeres is in at the end of the woods and orchards, and it consists of really three or four farms all the way around sort of hamlet, and then a centre core where there was a cafe and some shops and some fairly modern-type houses for 1944. And it was on the main road between Bayeux and... which was the main road, and that was the Langeres. And it was a fairly major junction for roads all the way through. We didn't know who was in there, except we thought that there were as I said, the enemy was stiffening there. And Humphrey Woods came back, and the attack, the plan of the attack was to advance along a track and a road which led into Langeres, which ran through the rather the middle of these woods, with six DLI on our left, and our objective was the centre of Langeres. And we were to attack with all four companies up, which was something that I wouldn't have thought was the right way of doing, but it's the way they did it in the desert. I raised a slight sort of query or eyebrow, however, I wasn't the boss. And two companies went on the right and two companies on the left. Humphrey Woods went with the two companies on the left, which was B and A and B companies. And I went with my radio operator and my valiant soldier servant with me.
What was his name, by the way?
Cook, Private Cook. And we went gallantly, I thought, between the two, crossed the corn. We were supported by the tanks of A Squadron, the 47 Dragoon Guards, who were utterly magnificent, as you will see later on in the battle. But they were out to the flank and shooting us in. Well, as we crossed the start line, all hell let loose from our own side, and what with typhoons and the artillery barrage and the tanks all shooting up the enemy positions in the wood, you could have seen the ground literally dance in front of you, and trees were coming down. And I thought to myself, good Lord, nobody can ever live in that sort of thing. We must be able to walk straight on to our objective. And so we crossed right on time, 10:15, crossed the start line, as I said, with Humphrey Woods on the left and me on the right. And we went through the corn, and the Geordies are never very tall guys, and the corn that year was extremely high, and you really had your sort of what-no thing coming over the top of the over the corn. And we marched about halfway across the corn with still with this barrage going on, and suddenly he saw the odd Geordie dropping in the corn, and he couldn't quite make this out where it was coming from, but in fact it was machine gun fire coming from the forward edge of the wood, and quite a lot of Geordies were dropping in the corn and casualties all the way along. And however, we advanced, and I spoke to Humphrey Woods on my radio, and this is the last time I heard him, and he said, we are running into terrible trouble here on the left. Most of the A Company officers, in fact, all the A Company officers are casualties. I am trying to get on with B Company, and I will try and see how it happens. If not, if we don't make any right, you go on, whatever you do, go on to the other side of the village, and I will try and collect as many of our side of the village and come around behind you, because it's obviously going to be easier on your side. And in fact, he was right, it was easier on our side, and apart from some fair amount of hand-to-hand fighting of C Company on the right, we got into the woods, and we had discovered afterwards that during the bombardment, the Germans had got their machine guns on fixed lines, and they had a string attachment to the machine gun, so they could lie at the bottom of their foxholes and then just pull the trigger, and the thing shot, the machine gun shot in enfilade fire right across his cord at the height of a man's body. And so they could lie at the bottom of these foxholes with all this stuff going on, eventually if you were a direct hit, you would head it. But otherwise, they were just pulling. This is really what is causing most of the casualties on the way up. And so by the time we had got into the woods, C Company had lost quite a few chaps. But B Company, I passed B Company through, and we got into the village, again supported by these marvelous 4th, 7th tanks who took every risk and were with us all the way. And got into the village where there was a scene of utter destruction. The church was practically in ruins, and a lot of the buildings had collapsed. And there was very heavy shelling coming from the far side of the village. And so I thought to myself, I suddenly had a message to say that Humphrey Woods had been killed. And I suddenly realized I was the senior officer in the place. And that made me the commanding officer. It filled me with utter despair to start with. And I suddenly realized I must do something about it.
Must have been extremely difficult to take overall command in a situation where
it was.
You only had one picture, half of the picture.
Only half of the lot, yeah. In fact, the carrier platoon came up, the anti-tank platoon came up, and I remember there was my gunner officer in his tank was up by the church in the main crossroads there, so I went to him, and we made a plan of where we'd have some artillery fires, which I could call for quickly. And luckily, here's where the training side came into it. It all came naturally. We had a little O group up at the top there, with the two company commanders, and the anti-tank platoon commander, and the carrier platoon commander, and the gunner, and the 4th, 7th squadron leader. We had a little O group there, at which we I allocated positions for the companies, blocking both the roads. And then I sighted the anti-tank guns. Again, I sighted those in the wrong area, facing down the road. I realized how wrong this was, because I suppose having sighted them and gone along to check where they all were, the first counterattack of enemy tanks came in. Luckily, no infantry, but enemy tanks. And, of course, sighting them down the road, all the German tanks was to shoot straight down the road, and they destroyed our anti-tank guns. And we lost the only three anti-tank guns that we had there, and they were destroyed, and most of the crew was shot up too. Luckily, the 4th, 7th Dragoon Guards had placed their tanks in enfilade, and as the Panther tanks came down the road, they brewed up four of these straight away, which were the most extraordinary sight. One, two, three, four, and the burning tanks there. So that was my first mistake I made as a commanding officer. The next mistake, or perhaps you might not say it was a mistake, but I thought to myself, with all my training, what does the commander do now? And I remembered a little phrase which was dominate the battlefield. It seems rather sort of out of place here, but I thought, well, now we had seen these German tanks just ahead of us, milling about over the other side. Luckily, again, no infantry. So I thought, well, we better take a patrol out and go and see where these tanks are. And stupidly, I went with Sergeant Jordan and Roy Griffiths from D Company and two other soldiers. And we crept along the bank of this two fields in front of us, very, very using the best of cover and fine infantry tactics, till we poked our nose over the far side, two fields away, over the top of the bank. And there was the first Tiger tank we'd seen and another Panther tank. And so I quietly said to whoever it was on my left who was carrying, we had a Piat anti-tank gun, which is one you carry on your right. I said, put the Piat tank gun, I quietly whispered this on the bank, and when I say fire, fire. And the Geordie looked at me in horror, and in fact it was Roy Griffiths who'd taken the Piat, and he said, I've never fired one of these bloody things before. And that really is a lesson, because he had carried that tank, and that Piat anti-tank gun, the whole way from England across the Channel. And the first time he wanted to use it, he'd never even fired it. So there's a lesson there from somebody, that you must not have any leaks in your training all the way along. However, I got hold of the thing, because I fired a good many of these things. And we brewed up the first tank, and I can see now the German officer rushing out of it, and two other chaps getting out of the driving seat. And so we thought it was time for us to go. And I've never run quite so fast in my life as we did on that field back home. And it was written up this in one of the training pamphlets as the first Tiger tank that had been destroyed by a Piat anti-tank gun, which was really quite interesting. However, we got back, and things were reasonably quiet then for some time, except there was a fair amount of rather nasty shelling. And I think the sort of impression that one got of that is, A, what a marvellous chap that gunner officer was, because he stood in the middle of those crossroads with his head out of his tank, with stuff flying all the way around, and gave a great air of confidence. I chatted him up a bit, and it was really unpleasant, and I thought to myself, afterwards I wondered whether I was frightened. I think I was absolutely desperately frightened, but quite honestly, I never sort of realized it. I had so much to do, and I felt the responsibility, and I mustn't be seen to be frightened anyway. And you were so busy trying to think what one should be doing that you didn't have time to be frightened. Then the next thing that happened was there was another counterattack developed from where those tanks were, but again, it was only tanks, and the 4th, 7th, and the gallant gunner officer put all his defensive fire down, and the Germans then left, and they withdrew from the place, and we held the town, and we reckoned then that we were in tight control of it. We had D Company facing one way and C Company another, and we had the tanks, and we had the guns, and we were there. And by this time, it was about 5:30, I suppose, in the afternoon. And then a message came up to us from brigade headquarters that we were going to be relieved. And I can't tell you how relieved we were. We got back to a sort of concentration near the orchard where we had our battalion headquarters. And I discovered then that with a full count, that the number of casualties were 22 officers and 222 soldiers, and out of a complement of, I think we were something in the region of 590, it made a pretty good hole in the 9th Dharmanite Infantry. And people will say, was it worth it? The only thing I can say is that we obeyed our orders. We captured the village, and therefore it was a major strategic and tactical advantage to the division, and it enabled the other battalions to pour through the gap. And so you have to make up your own mind whether it was worth it or whether it wasn't worth it. I just felt terrible that all those young Durham soldiers, and when you go to look at the cemeteries there, you look and you are amazed at the ages of some of them, 18s, 19s, 20s. And the worst thing in a way was having two battalions beside each other on this attack, because the 6th Battalion had quite a few casualties as well. All of them came from more or less the same area, such as Newcastle, Gateshead, Sunderland, all those parts of the world. A lot of them were splendid miners and mining families and mining villages. And to have all those people, casualties at once, the morale of those people in the Durham area and the Northumberland area was obviously very, very low at having so many casualties of their own relatives in one battalion.
Learned from this action, General Mogg, particularly as you yourself took charge at a most difficult time, and did you yourself learn anything out of which you could put into effect later on?
Harry, certainly I learned a hell of a lot. I mean, it was the first battle that I'd ever been in, first time I'd been properly under fire, and it made you realise what it was all about. And as I said before, I think that perhaps because I'd never been in before, I was perhaps impervious to the sort of danger that I was in. When one sort of thought about it afterwards, you thought that the chances of getting through that battle were pretty slim. It really 2-1 on that you were going to be knocked out. However, the lessons that came out of it, I think, probably were, first of all, that if you're going to do that sort of attack where there are wooded countries and infantry approaches, then the infantry training should have been used a great deal more, and not rarely to adopt a plan. And I'm not criticizing Humphrey Wood at all. To adopt a plan which was very much like the barrage and of the desert. And if we'd had more time, of course we didn't have that time, but if we'd had more time, we should have perhaps insisted on more time in which to discover exactly where the enemy positions were, done much more patrolling at nights. I believe the attack itself should have been done at night, or certainly in the early hours of the morning so that you got on the objective in daylight. I think if one had had the possibility of doing a great deal more reconnaissance, we'd have had much more chance of success. I think the putting all four companies in at once was a bit, as I said earlier on, is a sort of desert operation, whereas it would be better to put two companies in first and then keep the other two in reserve. And then you saw that two companies on the left were not, one company on the left was not going hard. You had two companies up your sleeve to be able to reinforce where it was successful. I mean, terribly easy to be wise after the event, but that in fact was the way one was taught to do it by the infantry tactics. Always keep a reserve. We had no reserve. We had committed all four companies. The lessons I've already brought out of sighting your anti-tank guns, that was my fault entirely, and I think I had a rush of blood to the head because I knew the answers to that. I think all the other things that worked very well were the actual orders that were given out apart from that, and the cooperation with the tanks and the gunners worked remarkably well, despite the fact that we hadn't really planned it very much. But it did happen to work out very well. As I say, the gunners and the 4th-7th were absolutely marvellous. And those were the major lessons, and we learned exactly what it's like to be in battle. We learned to know what your reactions are. I think one of the reactions as I have, I think perhaps mentioned already, is you suddenly find yourself in command of a lot of people you don't know, and you suddenly feel very lonely because you realize that you're responsible. You have got to wrap out the orders, and people are looking at you rather like Labradors sitting down on their hunkers, watching your face, and their ears prick occasionally when you look as though you're going to say something. And you have got to wrap out the orders, and they've got to be confident, and they make them feel that that you are confident, and that's not always terribly easy. But it is a lonely business. I certainly think it gave me a bit of confidence for the battles that followed, because if you have a success, and whatever you say, despite the casualties, it was a successful battle, because we captured the village, and it had a tremendous effect on the rest of the British plan. And so success is always a great thing for any commander, and I think most of my Geordies who were with me then realized that we had won the first battle that I'd been in command, and it stood me in fairly good stead all the way through. It made me realize that it's terribly important that every soldier all the way down knows what the plan's in and what's going on. I did try and do that by going round to as many as what was left of the battalion to chat up the Geordies and see what, stop them pinching all the champagne from the village and all that sort of thing. But telling them what was going on and encouraging them. And once your soldiers know what it's all about and have got confidence in the plan, you can get them to do anything. I think those were a little lessons, Harry.
What did you learn about the Germans in this first action?
Well, they were tough fighters. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the Panzer Lehr were one of the crack divisions. Of course, that was another offshoot of the battle. The Panzer Lehr, I think I'm right in saying, and 21 SS were very badly mauled in this affair. It was not only us, but all the way along the line, the 60i on our left and two other brigades. And they never really came into the battle again. And so it was perhaps a slight turning point in the success of the beachhead, because if those divisions had got on top of us, and that's why we were pushed in a bit earlier than we would have liked, but it was a question of catching these divisions on the hop, and which we did, and they had a tremendous mooring. And there's no doubt about it that the barrage and the Royal Air Force Typhoons must have created a tremendous number of casualties with the Germans. We found an awful lot of them lying around, of course, when we got through into the woods there.
Were there any weapons, obviously it's very early, but were there any weapons that the Germans had which you...
No, we knew more or less all the weapons. Of course, their 88 anti-tank gun, SP gun, was a marvellous gun, and it did do an awful lot of damage. And the only other thing that was new to us was the string attachment. When you're sitting in the bottom of a slit trench, fairly safe, and just pull the trigger and you're creating casualties, which was an easy way to go to war.
You'd had a lot of casualties. Obviously, these had to be replaced. Now, where were you getting your replacements from?
One thing that worked marvellously well was the way that the collection of the medical set-up collection. I mean, not a casualties there were, but quite a lot of dead, but there were quite a lot of walking wounded and wounded. And the medical side of it worked extremely well back to the clearing stations. As I said, at the end of the battle, when we were relieved, we came out of the line and we had a rest for 4 days. And we were reinforced by people from everywhere. Highland Light Infantry, light infantrymen, ACAC gunners. I had officers from all sorts, mostly infantry officers, but soldiers from being gunners. And the extraordinary thing was that they came and they all put on a beret with a Durham Rifle Infantry bugle horn cap badge. And in time, when we, as we went on with the battle, we had a few more successes, and they became more Geordie almost than the Geordies, and there was the most wonderful sort of DLI spirit. Although quite a few of them were jocks and Englishmen, and never expect to be English regiments to get that sort of same wonderful Geordie spirit that there was. And I think it wasn't, you know, the fact that we all fought at Waterloo or the regiments fought at Waterloo in a traditional way. That helps tremendously in formulating a family of the regiment. But it's really success in battle that formulates the thing. And if you are successful and you know that that cap badge has been successful, you like that cap badge. And you like the chums in you who wear the same cap badge. And that's really, I think, who's did it.
It must have been difficult to have men coming from such army background, particularly gunners, into the infantry role and have even more fighting to do.
Exactly, exactly.
How did you
I think
come out?
The proportion of AK gunners was quite small in relation. They were mostly infantry reinforcements. But at that time, when you suddenly get 220, anybody who's handy in the reinforcement quite often goes up. And it was, although gunners are trained in the infantry role, but they weren't experts by no means. But however, we all seem to fit in quite well. On the reinforcement side, I don't know if there's anything more I can say on that. Luckily, from the rest of the time that I commanded the battalion, we had nothing like that. I mean, if we had more than about 8 casualties in a battle, we were very...
What... to men when they've, in effect, finished a battle and have removed from the danger spot?
Well, I think one is of relief in that you're still in one piece. The other one is, of course, of desperate tiredness, because it does take it out of you, not only physically, but mentally, this thing. And when you're out of the line, and even then when we were out of the line, the odd shell was still coming over, and so you always had to keep fairly alert. But you, not many were alert, because the soldiers, certainly, what they want to do is just sleep. Sleep and sleep. And the officers were sort of trying to reorganize the whole battalion and get people in the right place, the right to fill up which platoons, as well, make sure some of the equipment that might have been lost is replaced. And the sort of quartermaster and MT officer and the echelons were all very busy trying to replace things, more and more ammunition up. If there was anything wrong, put it right. So the officers still had quite a lot to do. And I found that having been on duty all the night before the battle started, and then had the battle, I had really jolly nearly 48 hours without any sleep at all. But it's amazing, I didn't feel tired at all. I just feel slightly depressed that we lost so many casualties. Not slightly depressed, very depressed. But realized that's what it's all about. And we've just got to get on with the job. And so I then spent my whole time walking around those who were awake, meeting the new people who had arrived, and again trying to help the reorganization of the battalion. Probably had various conferences with various officers, but there was a sort of slight letdown feeling, except that it had been a success, that's the thing. People thought, well, my job, and everybody sent very grave, great congratulatory messages all the way around to the battalion having achieved this. And that's really what it is. And we really have to put that behind you now and think of the next. And the next was going on to baseball, Hotto, and I don't think of it. Rest after a battle like that enables you to tie up many of the things like which are so terribly important from the morale is writing to the next of kin. And I tried to make every single officer write a letter to the next of kin, and I tried to write to every officer's next of kin, and the officers wrote to soldiers' next of kin, and that took quite a lot of time, and for all those number, and also getting the addresses and all that sort of thing is quite difficult. So there were quite a few of those sort of things to be done. Was there anything else that I would have thought to think of? I don't think.